I want to quote, before I really get to where I'm going to go here this morning, I really want to quote a passage of Scripture that's found in Paul's epistle to the Colossian church at Colossae, beginning in the second chapter, which is going to lead to the subject I want us to look at. If you want to look with me, beginning in the 20th verse of 2 Colossians, we're going to read through the first part of the third chapter of the same epistle. If ye be dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are ye subject to ordinances after the commandments and doctrines of men? Those commandments being touch not, taste not, handle not, which all are to perish with using. Which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will, worship, and humility, and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh. If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. So Paul is here admonishing and encouraging and teaching the church at Colossae about these things. And he says, you are dead, and your life is hid with Christ, embedded in God. And he tells us, if you then be risen with him, seek those things which are above. I think the question that he's posing to us here is, it's an uncomfortable question. It's a self-examining question. Ever done a self-audit? Ever been in business? Corporations will do an internal audit of a department or whatever, and it's an in-house thing. Do we ever do an in-house audit? Take stock of ourselves? There's an uncomfortable question sometimes we might have to ask ourselves, and it relates to that last song that we sang. Where's your heart? Where is your heart? Have you set it on things above? If you being risen with Christ, you having the knowledge of who He is, where is the seat of our affections? Where is your heart? The Lord told us in the Sermon on the Mount, 6th chapter, wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. Right? The things that are real important to you, that's where your heart's going to be. Huh? I remember years ago, I thought that I'll never forget this. There was a terrible hurricane that hit South Mississippi, a ravaging hurricane that came up the Gulf. 200-mile-an-hour winds. I mean, this was Category 5 plus. There was a local man in that community that loved his boat. I mean, he was obsessed with his boat. Anything wrong with having a boat? No. No, nothing at all. But he forsook everything else for the pleasure of the boat. Guess where the boat ended up? When all the dust settled, the boat was on the front steps of his church house. Interesting, is it not? Where's our affections? Where's the seat of our affections? I want to use that point of where's your heart as a starting point for us to examine an Old Testament prophet. The prophet whose name not was, but he is. His name's still Amos. His name is still Amos. Now, he's with the Lord now, but his name was Amos, and his name is Amos today. And I don't know how familiar we are with Amos, but Amos is important. And of all of the Old Testament prophets, Amos, in the day that he lived among God's people in Israel, may have the closest similarity to where we are today as a nation, as a society, and as a people. We consider Amos one of the minor prophets. And the reason for that distinction or that categorization is not the fact that what he had to say wasn't important. It was perhaps amongst the most important things, but what we do is we consider today, according to Bible scholars that teach us, they tell us that there were essentially 12 minor prophets. And the reason for that distinction is not based on the message or the importance of anything other than the length of their prophecy. And the prophecy of Amos is 9 chapters. 9 chapters. Amos lived at a time of the divided kingdoms. He lived about 750 years before the birth of Christ. At a time of immense economic prosperity in Israel. Why? He had everything that an American politician would salivate over. Peace and prosperity. That gets you reelected, doesn't it? If you've got peace and you've got prosperity, you're going back in as a general conventional rule. Israel had that in this day and age. Yet, all was not well. And here was the prophet that exposed that question to that uncomfortable question to God's people. And they didn't like it. Didn't like it then, we don't like it today. I don't like it. Without getting too much ahead of myself, the prophet Amos is going to tell Israel two things. He said, first of all, God's going to give you clean teeth. Clean teeth. Well, I'm going to go to the dentist next month for my semi-annual visit, and I'm going to pay to get clean teeth. Okay? It's not what we're talking about. You see, the reason the teeth were clean, because they weren't being used in the manner that they were given. There was no food. Now, there was, in fact, a famine, but I don't think that's even what Amos is telling God's people. He's telling them in the midst of their prosperity, in the midst of their affections being centered on something other than the Lord, that there was going to come a day that there was going to be a dearth in the land. You know what a dearth is? It's a time of famine. And he says, and you're going to suffer a famine, and it's not going to be a famine of bread. There's not going to be a famine of food, but there's going to be a famine of the Word of God. There's going to be a time when you would desire righteousness to be preached to you, and it's not going to be there. What makes us think that can't happen today? Are we so self-absorbed that we think that can't occur again? The amazing thing about the day of Amos, it's almost a picture parallel to where we are today and right now. And I don't say this, and I don't look at this to get you down. I mean, that's not the... Because as we go through Amos, and Lord willing, this is going to take a little while to do this, Let me give you the good news. It's going to end upbeat. It's going to end with a glorious message. But we've got to go through some turbulence first. We've got some downtime that's going to have to be experienced before we get to that. And there will have to be an internal audit. There will have to be some introspection. Do not I love thee? Oh my Lord! How is it with us? Where is the seat of your affections? What's important to you? Where is your treasure? Because that's where I'm at. Wherever I find your treasure, that's where I'm going to find your heart, somewhere around it. And there's so many things to get God's children, those who are the blood-bought, those who are the foreknown, the elect, those who will one day live in heaven. There's so many things to get them off track. And it looks like we're getting more all along. What do people worship? You know what a lot of people worship? They worship their natural family. They worship them. Could be son, daughter, spouse. Now, God gave us the model, and He prescribed the pattern to which the godly family, the nuclear family, should function. But it's not the object of worship. We got people that worship the family. God's not honored. God's not pleased. We got people that worship their job. It becomes a game. The job becomes like a chess game. And we become obsessed with winning at the job. We worship victory. We worship in America today. We worship recreation. We take the blessing of God and we push the envelope to the max. And the joy in our heart is dampened. And we lose track of the joy that we have. I've just named some that are off the top of my head. We could worship the church. You know that? I'm thankful for the church. And I'm thankful that God has blessed the church where we're at. But we don't worship the church. We do not worship doctrine. I'm not a doctrine worshiper. Don't worship the gospel. I hold it in the highest esteem. That was a problem with the church at Ephesus. You had some doctrine worshipers. And Jesus rebuked them, said, "You have forgotten your first love." We've got to keep it in this right context, brethren. Where's our heart? Where's your heart? Where's my heart? That's what Amos, in this day of peace and prosperity, that's what the man was trying to convey to God's people in 9 chapters. You know, he was giving this message, and we're going to look at this beginning now. If you want to go to the book of Amos, we find some interesting things that occur here. First of all, he's going to say these things to the king. And you know what the king's going to tell him? Why, you're not even of the tribe of Levi. You're doing something that you're not even supposed to be doing. That's what he said. He said, "You're not a Levite." You know what Amos said? You're right. Levi said, "I'm two things. I'm a herder. I'm a herdsman." He herded sheep. And you know what else he did? He picked figs off of a sycamore tree. He gathered them. He harvested them out of the tree. And he brought those there and he agreed. He says, "But God told me to tell y'all some things. God told me to communicate with you on this." So with this context, we're going to begin and look at I hope to get as far along in this as I can, because we must understand the context of what is involved here. Now, it's amazing how God lays things out. It's an amazing thing to me how before God, through the mouth of this prophet, ever gets to the point of addressing the real purpose of this prophecy, he's going to deal with the enemies of God's people first. That's an amazing thought. And Israel as a nation, and Judah as the sister kingdom, Israel and Judah, they had enemies on their borders. And these enemies were marauders. They were men, they were terrorists. We think terrorism is something new today. No. It's just a new word. But the terrorists today did the same thing today that these neighborly marauders inflicted upon Israel. And God allowed it. God allowed it. He suffered it. You know why He suffered it? Because He was angered against Israel. And there's a principle that runs all through this, in that God allows, hear this careful, God allows the enemies of His people to have victory. Mm-hmm. Until His people, who are the objects of His affection, repent. Right. And then you know what He does? God destroys the enemies. Wow! God uses the anger and the hatred within them to punish His own people, to teach them a lesson. Now, that's God's pattern. You say, well, He just used them. You're exactly right. You are exactly right. He used them. He's God. Paul asked that question, does the potter have power over the clay? Well, of course, the answer to that is yes. He can do anything He chooses to do. So, before we ever get to the heart of the matter, God's going to deal with the enemies of God's people. And He's going to pronounce judgment upon the enemies of God's people before He ever gets to dealing with them. And in fact, that's going to take two chapters here. So we're going to go through that. We're going to see how God deals with the enemies of His people. The words of Amos, who was among the herdsmen of Tekoa. Tekoa was the city. Y'all remember the wise woman of Tekoa that went before David the king? And Joab had put her up to making up a story for, we must needs die. And there is water spilt upon the ground which cannot be gathered up again. Those words which were based on an untruth. She was lying. Joab put her up to making this up to try to persuade the king. Yet the irony to all of that is there are no truer words spoken in Scripture about you and I. She was the wise woman of Tekoa, which is about, according to the map that I look at, it's about 30 miles south of Bethlehem, down there around Hermon. The word of Amos, who was among the herdsmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. So this is marked in time at the time regarding a major earthquake that had taken place there. And he said, this is Amos talking, the Lord will roar from Zion and utter His voice from Jerusalem, and the habitation of the shepherds shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. The judgment is a drought. Those shepherds are going to be tending their flocks, and they're going to mourn in the fields because the grass will wither and die. And even on the top of Mount Carmel, it's going to wither. The place that was the coolest around due to the elevation, one of those snow-capped mountains, the top of the mountain is going to wither. God's judgment is upon His people. Now He's going to, for six expressions, we're going to see moving for the next two chapters. And there's an expression that you can look at that the prophet utters. He says, for three transgressions and for four. Remember that. For three transgressions and for four, God will not turn away judgment. So, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Because Damascus, now then we're talking about Syria. Remember, that's the enemy of God's people, the Syrians that were there. The Syrians had threshed Gilead with an instrument of iron. They had brutalized Gilead. They had brutalized God's people. And God had suffered it and allowed it to happen. Y'all remember back in the book of 1 Samuel, y'all remember where Eli was the high priest, and Eli had two sons that were committed abominations in the temple, and Eli didn't refrain his sons. He went to them and he said, boys, you really ought not do that. And he didn't come down on them like a ton of bricks, as he should have, and they were punished. In fact, that's when the Ark of the Covenant, which was a manifestation of the presence of God, that's what the covenant was. The Ark of the Covenant was. The Ark of the Covenant was what I could look at, what I could see that tells me that God is with us. And God became angry with His people because of this man not disciplining his sons as he should have. And there was a consequence. God allowed, He suffered the Ark of the Covenant to be taken by the Philistines, ungodly people. And it stayed there for a long time. In fact, it stayed there until Israel repented. And then, you know what God did? God, when He was through with the Philistines on that, He made a condition occur as a disease to those men of that army to where they literally took that Ark of the Covenant and they thrust it from their borders. And Israel got it back. But God used the ungodly to punish His people. There's a pattern there. Don't forget that. I'm amazed even today. I don't get political. This is not the place for politics. But how many years did we look for a man over there that bombed two buildings in New York City? How many years did we look for him? We got all this army. We got all these aircraft. We got GPS. And here's a man with kidney failure, riding on a camel in the mountains, and we can't find him. Think about that. How long did it take? Just consider it. God uses the ungodly to deal with His people. For three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away judgment because you abuse my people. You use threshing instruments of iron to slaughter Jews. And I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, that was the king, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. And I will break the gates of the bar, I will break the gates of Damascus, and cut off the inhabitants from the plain of Avon. And he that holdeth the scepter, he that's the king, shall go into captivity, shall be taken into slavery. That's God's punishment upon the Syrians. Verse 6, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away punishment thereof, because they, those of Gaza, those of the Philistines, we just talked about them, those of the Philistines carried away captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. But I will send a fire to the wall of Gaza, which shall devour the palaces thereof, and I will cut off the inhabitants of Ashdod, and him that holdeth the scepter, that's the king, will I turn my hand against Ekron, and the remnant of the Philistines shall die, they shall perish. This is a righteous God who used the ungodly to bring judgment upon his beloved elect people. This is a pattern here. Why do we think this doesn't apply today? Do we think, well, that, Brother Jared, that's the Old Testament. We live in the New Testament. Brethren, what was satisfied in the Old Testament was the ceremonial law. You know, I mentioned last week that you go to Temple Mount and you look at the structure of that temple, it was a slaughterhouse. Those priests, they looked like butchers. They had blood all over them. In fact, they had a ditch. They had ditches running off there. And that ditch was full of animal blood that when they would carve up those animals. And that high priest would take an animal and he would prepare it for sacrifice. And he would butcher it. And you know the first thing the priest did? That dead animal there, he went to the right shoulder and he cut off the right shoulder of that animal and he gave it to his wife. That's what they ate on. The priest was given out of the temple. He was paid. And he was paid first. In fact, Paul, in the 9th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul tells about that same experience. And Paul tells the Corinthian church, and he uses giving to the church, and the model is what we find in the Old Testament. It's not been done away with. But that Temple Mount, it was a slaughterhouse. And that was completed until the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. One of the things that I'm trying to look at here, I hope to expose and I hope we can contemplate. Y'all remember last week we looked at the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. And which is the prophecy of the prophet, who was, by the way, Isaiah was a contemporary of Amos. They lived at roughly the same time. And, of course, Isaiah was blessed by God to give us that 53rd chapter, which is the picture of Jesus, of the coming of this prophetic figure. And remember how it starts out, "Who hath believed our report?" What he's really saying there is, who would possibly believe this? Who would believe? To whom would this possibly be revealed? He says that in absolute awe. Then he speaks about this Jesus as a tender plant. You know, ever go out to a desert place and you find a tender plant growing? No. It's improbable. Not saying it's impossible, but it's improbable that I would go out there, you and I would go out there and find a young, tender, nourished plant growing in a desert place with no water. It's improbable. He describes Jesus further as a root out of a dry ground. What's the likelihood of going out there in that desert and finding a root coming up, a healthy root growing
where there's no water, or there's nothing that would nourish that. It's improbable, is it not? That's what the prophet was telling us. It is improbable that Jesus would come to Israel in spite of the promise that we have. Look at the nature of this people that he's going to come up in the midst of. He didn't come to Israel because of who they were. He did it in spite of it. It was improbable. He is a root out of a dry ground. And all of these things that we're going to look at right now are going to point to the fact that this people is just like us. You and I today are no different than these people. Despite our best intentions, we are depraved creatures according to the flesh. And until such time that Jesus comes down in the Holy Spirit and gives us a new heart, we're a depraved creature. And that flies against everything the world's going to tell you. And it takes you out of it. And you and I are not part of it. We had no part in it. When we were yet His enemies, He died for us. He knew us. That's the improbability of this Jesus coming to this time, to this place. And this is the improbability of a prophet coming and roaring at Israel and telling them that God's going to deal with you. And He's going to do it from the position of one question. Where is your heart? Where's your heart? They had everything they needed. They were fat and happy and entertained. We don't need God. We need God when it's convenient. So, that's what happens in Gaza. Verse 9. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Tyrus, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they, those of the city of Tyre. Now we're talking about the Phoenicians. Y'all know, are you familiar with a biblical map of that day? There was the country of Phoenicia, which was a seacoast city. Tyre, T-Y-R-E, and Sidon. Two cities there on the coast. God told His people, leave those folks alone. Why? Because they worship false gods. And you're going to get involved with them, and they're going to entice you to follow their gods. And that's going to make me angry. And I'm going to punish you. And I don't want to have to do that. But I will. Ever said that to your kids? I don't want to have to punish you. I don't want to have to discipline. But if you push me, I will. The same thing God said. But here were those residents of Tyre, and they were terrorists against God's people. For three transgressions of and four against Tyre, I will not turn away punishment. Because they delivered up the whole captivity. Why, they took Jews and made them slaves and took them into bondage and sent them down to Edom. Well, where's Edom? Well, we're fixing to find out. And I'm going to... And they delivered them up the whole captivity to Edom and remembered not the brotherly covenant. They had made an agreement with God's people. A covenant. A treaty. In fact, they had an agreement where they could traverse the country. They could go through the land at one time, but then they would crawfish on the deal. They weren't true to their word. They made a promise and they welched on the deal. That doesn't please God when we don't do what we say we're going to do. So God's judgment to them was that He'll send fire on the walls of Tyre, which shall devour the palaces thereof. You see a pattern here? Everybody who's a border country to God's people is having His judgment inflicted upon them. Now, there's an interesting thought here, Brother Jerry, and I thought about this. When did this happen? We don't know when these things... Did it all happen at one time? I don't think so. We don't have any idea the time frame under consideration of when all of these offenses against Israel occurred. But remember one thing, God doesn't forget. I don't think it all happened within a 2-week span. I think it coursed over the course of many years. All these things that we're listing here, but God doesn't forget. And He punishes these people for inflicting this upon His beloved people. But He's going to get to them later. Thus saith the Lord, verse 11, for 3 transgressions of Edom and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he, Edom, did pursue his brother with the sword. Now, first of all, who's Edom? Y'all know who Edom is. That's the land of Esau. That's the land of the red clay. That's a place down there toward the desert. And that's where Edom, that's where Esau lived. In fact, one of the prophets in Isaiah had a vision of God, of Jesus Himself coming out of that place. I believe it's the 63rd chapter, when He says, who is this? He's speaking of Jesus. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from the capital city, Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. All of these things, he's pointing to the prophetic view of this Jesus, who is this root out of a dry ground that's going to come out of this gainsaying people. But God says, I'm going to punish the descendants of Esau. Why? Because he did pursue his brethren with the sword and cast off all pity. Had no compassion. We sang that song this morning. Y'all remember? Show pity, Lord. What is pity? Pity is fellow compassion. Jesus showed pity on those that were without, as a sheep without a shepherd. Jesus, God shows pity upon us. And Edom was cynical and stiff-necked and self-righteous and thought they had it all figured out. They worshiped their mental intellect. They did cast off all pity, and his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. He had some deep offense deep down buried in him, and that root of bitterness ate out his insides. Poison is a dangerous thing. Let it go. Let it go. But I will send fire upon Teman, that's in Edom, and which shall devour the palaces of Bozrah, the capital city. Thus saith the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Ammon, and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they, the Ammonites, by the way, that's present day Jordan, the city of Jordan, Ammon, the capital city of Jordan. Well, there were those that lived there in that place, and they did something abominable. They had a god, and his name was Chemosh. Chemos. And I've talked about this before. You know what they did there? They took babies. And they sacrificed them to Chemosh and to Moloch. An abomination. Live babies, put them in the fire. And it angered God. When we sacrifice our babies, chew on that one. For I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have ripped up the women with child
of Gilead, Hebrew women, that they might enlarge their border. But I will kindle a fire in the well of Rabbath, and it shall devour the palaces thereof, with shouting in the day of the battle, with a tempest in the day of the whirlwind, and their king shall go into captivity, and he and his princes together, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. So we got one more. We've done four. Now here's the fifth one. Moab. For thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions and for four. You see a pattern there? You see how he's... If you take the map and you look at Israel of the Bible times and you go all the way around Israel, we're looking at every border country that gave grief to Israel. And God's judgment came upon them. For three transgressions of Moab and for four. Well, who was Moab? Well, Moab... First of all, Moab was the son, the illegitimate son of Lot. Okay? And they were not Hebrews. They were an ungodly people. And you go back to Genesis and you're familiar with the account of who the Moabites were and what they were. And as a nation, they were ungodly. Now, here's where you got to get so careful. We can't paint everything with a broad brush always. Because guess who else was a Moabite? Y'all know? Ruth.
Yes.
Ruth. Ruth. She was one of the ancestors of that root out of dry ground. So you see, we got to be so careful when we paint things with a broad brush. And we categorize whole groups of people. But God's judgment came on the Moabites. I will not turn away punishment because he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. And I will send fire on Moab. And I will cut off the judge from the midst thereof and will slay the princes thereof with him, saith the Lord. Now, we're through with the enemies of God's people. Now we're fixing to see what God says about His people. Now, this is interesting to note. As we study this man, Amos, he was a native of the village of Tekoa, which was in the kingdom of Judah. Not Israel, but Judah. But he's going to reserve God's going to reserve his greatest judgment not upon Judah, but it's going to be upon Israel, the northern kingdom. For thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah and for four, I will not turn away punishment thereof, because let's look at what Judah did, because they have despised. They held in contempt. They held in derision the law of God. They ridiculed it. They ridiculed it. They despised the law of God and have not kept His commandments, and their lies caused them to err, the which their fathers have walked. But I will send a fire into Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem. You see, you look at the geography, the city of Jerusalem was within the kingdom of Judah. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel, and for four, I will not withhold punishment. I will not turn away judgment. I will long suffer them no longer. Look what Israel did that angered God. Let's see if we see any parallels here. Because they sold
the righteous for silver. Because they, and the poor for a pair of shoes. Now, remember, brethren, the context is Israel is having peace and prosperity as they have never known. They're more prosperous than they've ever been. Yet, they are as dead men's, they're as whited sepulchres. That's what Jesus said about the Pharisees. He says, you are as whited sepulchres. While we walk past that cemetery and we look at that tombstone and it's glistening white, but what's on the inside? That's how you look on the outside, is you look all prettied up. But on the inside, you're a wasteland, a spiritual wasteland. And your heart is not with me. Because they have sold the righteous for silver. Well, you know, that's what Joseph's brothers did. Jews, they sold their brother for silver. They had contempt for God's law. What was God's law? Whatever Jacob says it was. Right? Jacob says, take care of my boy. Well, they despised that law. What did Judas do? He sold the righteous for silver. Who? Jesus. Because they have sold the righteous for silver. You know, this is broad spectrum. This could have related to their civil. Their judges were so corrupt. Why they would find a man guilty who was innocent if you'd pay him off. Or they would fail to prosecute those who were guilty if you'd pay them off. Remember that unjust judge that Jesus spoke about? And that woman that cried unto him constantly? Why, that's typical of what they had in that day. That man didn't want to be bothered. But because she kept annoying him, he gave her what she wanted. That was the point that the Lord was making in terms of our supplication to him. I will not turn away punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes that pant after the dust of the earth. What does that mean? Now remember over there when... Now remember when David was the king and he was someplace he shouldn't have been, on a roof, and he saw a woman. He should have been with his troops, leading them and guiding them, but he was someplace he had no business being. And that's when we get into trouble, a lot of times. Not always, but it's a good rule anyway. You know what happened? The prophet Nathan comes to him after all of this is done. He says, boss, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you something. Okay. He said, there was this man that had all these sheep. He had more than he could say grace over. He couldn't keep track of what God had blessed him with. Full-time job keeping up with what God had given him. That fits me there. Stop right there. But he looked over there and he saw this one little shepherd. And had one little ewe lamb. And he coveted something that wasn't his. I want what he's got. And he takes it. He takes it. Nathan says, what you think about that, king boy? I bet David... His face turned as red as a beet. He said, who is he? Where is he? Where's that man? This ain't going to end here. And I'm paraphrasing. Nathan says, well, boss, I'm glad you said that. Because you're the man. You're the man. You had all of this, yet you wanted somebody else's wife. And you instigated all this scheming and cover-up to want what belonged to somebody else. And that faithful soldier who slept on your doorstep, and you sent him to the battle demanding that he die, and he did. See, that's what Israel did here. They had more than they could say grace over, but they went out and found some poor people that didn't have a real little, and they says, I want what he's got. And that made God so angry. That's what covetousness will get you. Wanting what somebody else has got. I got more than I can handle. Thank you, Lord, for what you gave me. You see, brother, at the heart of covetousness is unthankfulness. It's ungratitude for what we do have. That's what Israel was guilty of. They pan after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor and turn aside the way of the meek. And a man and his father will go into the same maid to profane my holy name. That's self-explanatory. It needs no further explanation. And Israel lays themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar. While people would put up something for collateral in terms of a business transaction, and they were thieves. They were thieves. They would go take something that didn't belong to them. And it angered God. And they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. Here's how petty Israel got. Y'all remember when the Lord was on the cross? They brought to him wine mixed with myrrh. And of course he refused it. But that was a common occurrence in that day. Is to a condemned man, as he was dying, they would give him a drug to numb the pain. Okay? And these Jews are so depraved, is they go to where the executions are taking place and they steal the wine. Wow. Wow. Then God tells Israel, reminds them what he did for them. Yet, I destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of a cedar. Why? All your enemies fell below you, and it was because of me I gave you the victory. Yet you have forgotten all these things, and you have turned unto yourselves. I raised up your sons for prophets, verse 11, and of your young men for Nazarites. Y'all know what a Nazarite was. He was a man that a razor never touched his head, and he was forbade from tasting any wine or alcohol of any kind. That was his covenant. That was his oath. That what would touch his lips. And he made that vow to God. But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink. You defiled them. And you commanded the prophets, saying, don't prophesy to us. Don't preach to us. Isn't that a sad commentary when we get to the point to where I don't want nobody preaching to me? Tell you what. I try to go to meetings, and it's a wonderful thing to go someplace and hear other men make an effort to preach. It's sweet. But Israel got in such a bad shape to where they said, we don't want preaching. We don't need preaching. You know, in an America today where the church has become a consumer item, and we want to go to the church that gives us the best deal, like we want to go buy a car. Just give me the best deal. What have you got for this or that? Well, we want some place that the children like. You ever heard that? Well, since when did the children call the shots? This isn't the Chuck E. Cheese's. And that's what a lot of people view today. Don't preach to us. In fact, what we're doing today is becoming rarer. We want theatrics. We want balloons. We want PowerPoint. We want concerts. But let's cut that preaching down to 10 minutes. Acts. Don't preach to us. You know what? They're going to get their wish. Be careful what you ask for. That's exactly what they're going to get. The prophet is going to say that the house of Israel is as a house of cucumbers. He said, "Oh, I love cucumbers." No, you don't love these cucumbers. You don't love when the house has become overgrown and is thrown away and you can't even get in because it's been forsaken. That's what he's talking about. "Behold, I am pressed under you." This is what God says. I'm fixing to wrap up. "I am pressed under you." This is God speaking to Israel. "I am pressed under you as a cart is pressed that is full of cheese." I remember when I was a kid, my granddaddy had a little farm down in South Mississippi and they raised corn. And at harvest time, Brother Jimmy, that little wooden cart, little wooden wagon would get loaded down with corn. I mean, it was way up the top. And it looked like those old wheels with that grease on it. Just looked like they was just going to collapse. Well, that's what the Lord's describing here. He said, "I'm underneath that and I am weighed down under the pressure of your sin. I am pressed under you. And I'm not going to put up with it anymore." That's what God said. "As a cart is pressed that is full of sheaves," or full of corn. Here's the corn. "Therefore, the flight shall perish from the swift." Those that worship their prowess and flight, they're not going to fly anymore. You know, go over to the... I'm closing now. Over to the book of Haggai. They didn't do what God had told them to do. We looked at this a couple years back. Remember when God says you're not doing what your God has told you to do? He says everything you do, none of it's going to prosper. He says you're going to drink and you're going to be thirsty. Remember that? Now, by the way, Haggai lived about 200 years after Amos. You're going to drink, but you're going to be thirsty. You're going to eat, and you're still going to be hungry. And your wages, the money that you earn, is going to be as coins put in a bag that has holes in it. You ever at the end of the day, you ever wonder where the paycheck goes? You mean, I started out with this, and this is what I got? You know that? Well, it was 10 times worse than that here. "Return to me." That's what the prophet's saying. That's what he's saying to God. "Nothing you do will prosper until you're obedient to what I have said." Remember, brethren, what's the original question? Where's your heart? We're going to get there. We're going to move forward with this. Again, this is going to end beautiful. It's going to be great. So, may the Lord bless us in this and in everything we're blessed to uncover and to do. We're going to stand now and sing a hymn, Brother Walton, if you've got one.
194. Who is it that comes from?